Welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today is special guest David Liddle, founder of online investment advisory service Ipso Facto Investor. Today we're discussing how to find the right investment strategy. Investors dedicate a lot of time to trying to find the best shares or funds, but if they don't have a coherent strategy or portfolio construction, a random selection of investments won't necessarily achieve their goals. David, if an investor doesn't have an investment strategy, what are the first steps for determining the right one?
Well, Leonora, I think the starting point for investment is always to set an objective. What are you investing for? This may seem pretty obvious, but it's also important. The objective can be pretty vague. You may just want to build up a general pot of money for some indeterminate point in the future. Or it may be very specific, saving for a deposit on a house in 5 years' time, for example. You may want to generate income now, or you may be saving for retirement within a pension fund, or to complement your pension. At the same time as setting the objective, you need to review your circumstances. What is my income, prospects, existing wealth, age, etc.? The combination of setting your objective with an audit of your personal circumstances can then be used to determine your asset allocation and investment strategy, along with an assessment of your risk appetite.
That's quite an important point, because I think a lot of people underestimate or overestimate their risk appetite. How do you determine what your risk appetite is when you're choosing an investment strategy?
This is an interesting one, Leonora, because I'm not sure that the financial services industry has got this quite right. And that is partly because it is difficult to do. Risk appetite is really about how much tolerance, how much we are prepared to put up with a significant loss in value of our investments. But I think most people, when asked this question, would have a fairly low tolerance. But that may not always be the right answer. I don't think that risk appetite can be determined in isolation. It needs to involve your objective, your current circumstances, and it may change over time. In my view, an assessment of risk appetite also should involve a discussion around the value and risk of each asset class at the time that investment strategy is being determined. For example, traditionally, someone who said they had a low risk appetite would be directed towards bonds. A model portfolio, which is used by some financial advisors to asset allocate for their clients, at the beginning of this year, for a cautious investor, had 69% in fixed income or bonds, 4% in property and 27% in equities. But with 10-year gilt yields in January at 1.5%, the possibility of capital loss from holding gilts was really quite high. Having bought a 10-year gilt in January, yielding 1.5%, if 5 years later, 5-year interest rates were 3.5%, which is not an impossible scenario, the capital loss on the gilt would be 10%. So I'm not sure this is most people's definition of cautious. Perhaps cash would be the better option at that point. So I think risk appetite needs to incorporate a view of current valuations. At Ipso Facto, we think most investors want to know what is the best asset allocation strategy for current circumstances to give them a decent chance of making a reasonable return over the long term. Our core asset allocation advice is based on current relative valuation, adjusted for risk. Investors can then be more cautious or more adventurous according to their tolerance of risk or volatility.
Some interesting points there. Obviously, this isn't the easiest thing to do, and I imagine people do some things they regret. So as you're going along, what common mistakes should you try to avoid?
Yes, well, I think the most obvious mistake is to be too influenced by what is fashionable. What is the fashionable asset class or sector of the day, and not to pay enough attention to valuation. The Warren Buffett mantra about being fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful is excellent advice. In other words, don't follow the herd. So one, avoid buying the market when it is relatively expensive or selling when it is cheap. Two, avoid having too many assets concentrated in too few sectors. Three, don't overtrade, but do review your investments regularly to make sure they are meeting your objectives. We are all perhaps prone to sticking our heads in the sand when things are going wrong. Sometimes doing nothing is the right answer. But we need to have good reasons for inactivity, Having a disciplined investment strategy will help in this regard. So don't follow fashion. Don't have too much concentration. Don't get too attached to particular investments. When you've made a decent amount of money, take some profits.
Yes, that's interesting what you say about discipline and buying and selling, because the reader in this week's Portfolio Clinic is actually a regular saver. What are the arguments for investing lump sums regularly, what some people call pound cost averaging?
Quite simply, that it takes any market timing decision, which is notoriously difficult, out of the hands of the investor, and you buy more of an investment when it is cheap and less when it is expensive. It's therefore an automatic way of following the Warren Buffett advice to be greedy when others are fearful and fearful when others are greedy.
Okay, and obviously there's a lot of different investments. Is one investment better for this than another, or can you do pound cost averaging with any kind of investment?
Well, we think collective investments like investment trusts, providing deeding charges are not too high, are very well suited for this sort of approach. An added bonus is if the investment trust has a reasonable income yield, then that dividend compounds up together with your regular investment. With investment trusts, you may also get the advantage of discount volatility, meaning that the trust can be on a large discount when you're buying it, and therefore it becomes particularly cheap.
Okay. And are there any instances when you shouldn't pound cost average?
Well, I think to work well, pound cost averaging needs to be given time. So you would probably not want to do it if your saving period was limited to a few years. But then that would apply to any sort of equity investing. You would want to avoid investments where dealing costs were high or liquidity low. So any investment where the market capitalization or size of assets is low. Generally, pound cost averaging should work best for more volatile investments. So this would tend to favour equities over bonds.
Okay. Now you said in terms of things to avoid, what would be one or two examples of investments to avoid pound cost averaging?
Well, I think the smaller capitalised investment trusts, for example, where you can get a big spread on the on the trusts. I think alternative investments like hedge funds, you probably wouldn't want to be doing that as a pound cost averaging exercise.
Yeah, okay. Now, in the reader portfolio, you also mentioned quarterly investing, where somebody's ISA or savings account provider has very expensive charges, making monthly investing, maybe not very effective. Is investing on a quarterly basis, is it as good as, say, like monthly investing, which is maybe what a lot of people do, pound cost averaging?
Yeah, I think the important thing is to invest over a long period of time. Ideally, that would be monthly, but quarterly is okay too, just as long as it's done on a regular basis. But the important thing is to be investing over a number of years.
Okay. Turning to the budget this week, Chancellor announced quite a lot of things and covered quite a lot of ground. Now, David, for private investors, out of all the things that were said, what would you say are the most important things?
Well, what may be the most significant item for savers in the long term? Unfortunately, we don't know the outcome now. This relates to tax relief on pension contributions, where there is going to be a consultation. What we do know, as was foreshadowed, is that from April 2016, higher rate tax relief for additional taxpayers, those earning over £150,000, will be restricted below the current £40,000 limit, tapering away the annual allowance to a minimum of £10,000. But the Chancellor suggested that he was thinking of a much more radical shake-up of pensions taxation, in that tax relief on pension contributions might be withdrawn altogether, to be replaced by an ISA-style regime where income from pension funds would be tax-free. Possibly, contributions would be chopped up by the government on some sort of means-tested basis. This would have the advantage for the Treasury in generating more tax revenue early on, but would seem to be against the general theme of encouraging savers. At this moment, everyone can get tax relief on pension contributions up to the lesser of their income or earnings in £40,000. So whilst you may need to take account of what your employer is contributing, many people might actually be able to contribute more. And for example, they could get tax relief on this amount rather than paying into an ISA. But this is an area where it's sensible to take some specialist advice. I think we need to watch this space. The other point we do know, aside from changes to inheritance tax for family homes and some tinkering with buy-to-let, relates to the taxation of dividends. Here, there is yet more incentive to place assets into ISAs, since whereas previously basic rate taxpayers had no more tax to pay on dividend income, now if they have more than £5,000 of dividend income, they will pay tax of 7.5% on the excess. So people should consider transferring shares held in their own name or in an ordinary investment account into an ISA if they have capacity.
Okay, some good things to consider there, and we'll actually be following up on the dividend tax in next week's issue. Now, earlier this week, personal finance writer Kate Bailey interviewed Kenneth McKenzie, manager of Target Healthcare REIT. He told Kate why he thinks care homes are a good investment.
Kenneth, what is attractive about the care home sector compared to the more wider kind of commercial property areas?
I suppose the first thing that's unusual about it is that our property assets have 25 to 30 year leases, which are not breakable. So the average length of lease for the commercial property sector is I think, about 7 years. And we are four times that. We're actually slightly more than four times that. So there's you're able to have a very long view on the income characteristics of the fund.
And is that linked to inflation, that income?
Yes. Our leases all have an RPI link. In our particular case of the 29 leases that we have in place, one of them is a fixed uplift and all the others are RPI linked with collars and caps.
Okay. And so what is attractive about the sector kind of more widely in terms of demographics and, you know, and kind of supply and demand?
Well, the underlying fundamentals are all about the baby boomer. Mm-hmm. And as you look forward for the next 20 years, the number of over 85s doubles in the next 20 years. And on average, 15%, slightly more than 15% of the over 85s end up in residential care. Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of big picture in terms of what's going to happen in the next few years.
So the demand is high then.
So demand is very significant as you look forward. The other aspect of it is that today there are 480,000 beds in the sector, but beds with wet rooms, which we believe are really truly fit for purpose beds, are about 70 or 80,000 of these. And it's only that part of the sector that we actually invest in. So there's around about 400,000 beds which don't have wet rooms and are less fit for purpose. Some of these need to be invested in, and then there's probably 100,000 beds that needs to leave the sector. Mm. So there's a significant opportunity in the sector to grow a business.
Okay, because I mean, that was going to be my next question, really. We obviously have this demand, but in terms of the assets out there, the supply of assets that you want to invest in and that make kind of good parts of your portfolio, is there a good supply? You said there aren't that many with these wet rooms.
Yeah, there is a limited supply. This is not a sector where, you know, we could be adding thousands of beds per year. Across the UK, about 6,000 new beds are added per year. Mm-hmm. And we think that with the demographic bulge that we spoke about earlier, that needs to grow probably by 50 or 60% for a number of years. There are some signs that is beginning to happen, but we're just at the beginning of that.
Because, I mean, obviously, there's a big disparity in the quality of care homes, I would assume,
yes,
across the UK. And they have received some quite bad publicity, haven't they, in recent years. We've had kind of Southern Cross and Orchard View. So this obviously isn't a universally appealing sector. What exactly do you look for when you're choosing?
Yes, there's a big disparity, both in terms of the physical room. If you built a care home 15 years ago, the room was just actually physically smaller, probably a third the size of what we are building today. Mm. There probably were not wet room facilities in these days. So there's a physical disparity in that way. And then there's also the whole aspect of the standard of care itself. And care ultimately is personal and individual and local, we think best. And so part of our focus is to be working with local companies in local regions, and deeply engaged in their communities, and rather than working in the more corporate end of the market. We actually think running care homes is just a difficult business. It's a highly rewarding business when done very well, because ultimately the people who are cared for, I was with an investor this morning and he was saying his mother has dementia, and speaking about the wonderful way in which she has blossomed with her dementia by moving into a care facility. So that's one of the things we love about it. People actually live better and live longer and more contentedly in these latter days of their lives. But that's about the employees of the care facility putting their lives into that and providing a holistic care. And that's a key part of what we are trying to assess at all stages.
Mm. So with that in mind, how many assets do you currently own? How many are these all care homes or
yes, other kind of? We exclusively invest in care homes, and we have 28 care homes in our ownership at the moment. We exchanged this week for number 29, but that's what we do.
And I mean, are you aiming to grow that?
Yes, we are. We are on the main market of the London Stock Exchange. So we have a market capitalization of about 150 million at the moment. 150 million wouldn't be the kind of size that people would expect to be on the main market in the medium term. And it's our aspiration to grow the business as opportunity arises, opportunistically, and always mindful of trying to make the right kind of return to our shareholders.
Mm, and I mean, what are the kind of margins like on something like a care home versus a different kind of property asset? Is it kind of easy to find profitable, you know, businesses here?
Yes, a good modern purpose-built care home can often be a profitable proposition, but it's very localised and it's very much subject to the local supply and demand and the care standards exhibited by the operator. So that's our focus continually, doing that local assessment and understanding the care home within its local community, giving value for money and making sure the residents are well looked after. It can be profitable. In many cases, it is profitable.
And I mean, so is that the key risk then? What are the key risks here for the kind of sustainability of the portfolio?
I think one key risk is oversupply in very localised markets. A further key risk is the whole ethos of the operator. Is he in it for short-term gain? Because there is short-term gain sometimes. Or is he in it for a long-term, a holistic view of care of the community?
Okay. And so what are we looking at in terms of income? What's the dividend?
So our Target Healthcare REIT pays a 6% dividend on the issue price anyway. And with an RPI link, our share price today is 106 or 107. So it's probably more like 5.6 or 5.7 or something like that on the current share price. But that's our goal, to be paying that kind of income going forward. And we're a lowly geared product. So you mentioned the word Southern Cross earlier. Mm. We're the opposite of what Southern Cross did. Southern Cross did not own any property. Mm-hmm. They were a single operator risk. Right. The investor invested in the post-rent profit stream. Our rents are all covered, paid to us first before the operator gets his profit into his own pocket.
Okay.
We are property backed, so a fundamentally different proposition to Southern Cross. And we've tried to approach this in a very holistic, conservative way. And I believe that's one of the reasons why we've been so well supported by our shareholders.
Mm, I mean, do you have a commitment to increasing the dividend year on year, or are you just
saying
for that 6% yield?
No, we have we speak about the dividend having an RPI link. Mm. So our underlying rents typically are going up 1 or 2% per annum. Mm-hmm. Depending on where RPI is, and we're a REIT, we plan to pay out what we earn.
Okay.
We're not about preserving, retaining cash within. The whole REIT model really is a flow-through model, the most tax-efficient way for people to invest in property. Mm.
And should investors be thinking about this as kind of increase in capital year on year as well as income, or is this an income investment?
Yeah, well, it's fundamentally an income investment. So, you get your 6% return, but then because rents are going up 1 or 2% a year, the NAV will go up 1 or 2% a year without any yield shift. So there could be something like 7, 8, 9% total return if there's no yield shift. So, okay. And if you get that compound over a longer period, that's probably as good as you're going to get anywhere.
Mm. And you say with the kind of rents going up about 1 or 2%, have the value of the properties in your portfolio increased?
Yes, and sometimes a little more than that in the light of us buying them when they're at a less mature stage, and as they come through to maturity, the value changes.
Mm, because, I mean, sometimes we look at other almost similar REITs, things like student property REITs, mm-hmm. and you've seen the kind of capital appreciation there just shoot up.
Yes.
Is this similar or
no, at this stage it's not. Yields have changed more in some of the other sectors than they have in the care home sector. Mm. We're one of the significant buyers in the care home sector in the singles and ones and twos side of the market. And yields have moved more slowly in that than in some of the typically GCP student living, that kind of business, they are buying in bigger scale and yields have moved more in the larger scale type transactions.
Okay, so the REIT is trading at quite a premium at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
Although not as high as some of the kind of more traditional property ones where we've got real double digit kind of mid-20s premiums. I think the premium today is about 11-12%, isn't it?
Yep.
And how has that changed? Because I know that's actually increased quite a bit already since March. So
yes, but we have that premium. I guess people are seeing that we're a stable and long-term opportunity, and the NAV is underlying it is growing, and the whole demographics of the story is growing. And each time as we've gone to the market, we've been well received by the investor group, and so there's some desire for our shares, which I guess is reflected in that premium. We have to kind of humbly go on in our way doing the underlying job right, and hopefully the share price will take care of itself as long as we do the underlying task properly.
I mean, it's obviously a slight concern for some investors if that premium is going up and up and up. Will you be doing anything to kind of control that, to bring it down?
No, I wouldn't like to pretend that I have such authority over the market that I would be able to do that.
You could sell more shares potentially, could you, to bring it down?
Well, our issue there is that we don't want to raise cash that's sitting in our balance sheet and not deployed, because that's to everybody's disadvantage.
Okay.
So we will do more fundraising as opportunity arises in the light of our perception of future demand in the following months. And therefore, there is likely to be further fundraises as we see opportunity going forward. But that's really tied to as we invest the money.
Okay, so you would need to kind of have an asset in mind maybe before doing a fundraising.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And are you on the lookout now? Are you always on the lookout for new ones?
Yes, always on the lookout. We're always, we always have in mind when we next do fundraise, and we always have in mind what are the assets that we're buying all the time. We're negotiating all the time. It's a pretty dynamic kind of situation in the light of what's happening in the market.
Okay. Have you got kind of a target size of the portfolio that you're aiming for, or is it a case of...
I've been asked that question many times, and my usual answer to it is something along the lines of, if I spend your money wisely, the chances are I'll be able to come back and get a little more from you in the future.
Okay.
In the past, I've run businesses where we cast a vision for how big we were going to be. I'm not in the mind of doing that in this. We have an opportunity to build a business of scale as long as we remember the knitting and do the fundamentals well.
And just kind of much more broadly, but how does the UK care home sector compare to the kind of international market? Obviously, you're looking very locally, aren't you? And that's part of your focus. But
yes, there's a very interesting corollary if you look at what happened. has happened in America, where there are three very large healthcare REITs, a market cap of about $20 billion each.
And how long have they been going?
25 years.
Right.
Very stable. The US healthcare REIT market is probably market cap of $80 to $100 billion.
Wow.
The UK version of that is four REITs with a market cap of maybe $1 billion. So there's probably a little opportunity for us to grow because we are only a sixth of the size of the population. Mm. But
I mean, is the UK following a similar track in terms of, you know, the demographics and the demand
yes.
and the dynamics?
Yes, the demographics in America are very similar to our own. The way the care home stock in America is owned is very similar to our own. The REITs are more embedded in the sector than they are currently in our sector, and that's part of our opportunity.
Okay, so but why the focus on UK for you?
Because it's what we know.
Okay. Yeah. So just finally, how should investors, looking at this, how should they think about this as part of their portfolio? It's income, it's capital growth.
Yes, it's a long-term, stable product, which will throw off regular income on into the future with some capital growth.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Kenneth McKenzie.
Thank you.
Some interesting income ideas there. Kate also spoke to Evie Hambo, manager of IC Top 100 fund BlackRock World Mining Trust, about why he still thinks investing in mining royalties is a good strategy, despite having had to write down some of his investments last year.
Now, the commodities and mining sectors have been notoriously troubled in recent years and particularly affected by a slowdown in global growth and some very high-profile collapses. Now, the Trust had a bad year in 2014, which some have called the worst in your 21-year history. NAV declined by over 26% and share price by over 30%. And a major part of that was linked to the high-profile collapse of London Mining, which was a company hit by the Ebola crisis and by falling iron ore prices. Now, that went into administration in October last year. And you were very affected by that, weren't you, because of a strategy to invest in unquoted investments and royalties. Now, what does that mean, this strategy to invest in unquoted investments?
Last year was a very difficult year for us. As you said, it was one of the worst in the Trust's history. We had, in the prior 2 years, we had gone down a path of trying to reduce the discount which the Trust was trading at. And one of the elements of that strategy was the attractiveness of income in the market, where investment trusts that were trading with a yield of greater than 3.5% were trading on a less than a 5% discount to assets. And since inception, the Trust has, apart from the kind of first month or so since it was launched in 1993, had traded at a large discount to assets, 17% or so. And so with the ability to close the discount to assets and the potential to pay out income and the rising income inside the Trust, 3.5% was a very achievable target. In order to prevent volatility in the dividend, we had to diversify our income. And the strategy we went down was looking to buy into a royalty or a portfolio of royalties.
It means that you're giving money to a company and they will pay you out in the future from their proceeds. How does it work?
The royalty contract we had with London Mining was linked to the price of iron ore because they're a producer of iron ore from the Marampa mine in Sierra Leone. And so as production went up and down into the future and as prices went up and down, that would generate the revenue and we would get a fixed share of the revenue for that royalty contract. So it met a number of goals. First of all, it was diversity of income for us. Secondly, it was tied to commodity prices because we wanted the commodity price exposure. And thirdly, it also exposed us to the upside in the asset because the asset was a very, very long life asset. And with the further investment of capital into the asset, production was likely to grow over time. And so we made that investment in 2012, and the investment performed very well until we had the deterioration, as you mentioned, with regards to Ebola and the iron ore price in the second half of 2014. And obviously ended up with the company going into administration in that year. So that was an incredibly disappointing outcome, but the strategy itself remains a very sensible strategy.
But just going back to the London mining royalty, how much did you pay for that and what was the impact of the write-down?
So when we made the investment, it was just over 5% of the trust's assets. It was a $110 million investment when we made it. And that obviously got written down to zero, and we received just over $10 million of payments back to us.
And there was a bond as well, was there not? A royalty and also a bond?
Yeah, so we originally, prior to making the royalty investment, we had investment in the shares of London Mining. We also had an investment in the corporate bond that London Mining had issued. When we made the investment into the royalty, we sold down our investment in the shares and we maintained our investment in the bond because the bond had a very, very good yield and the prospects for the bond were, you know, very encouraging.
But was that bond investment not also written down?
Yes.
And how much was that written down by?
That was written down to zero as well.
Okay. And it's not the only one of these that has been written down, is it not? Wasn't the Banro Corporation?
Banro wasn't written down. So in BlackRock, we have an internal pricing committee, which is independent of the investment teams. And the pricing committee values anything that doesn't have a regular market quote or is unquoted. So when liquidity in the Banro bond was reduced in the market because it hadn't been trading, so effectively this price became stale, then they made an adjustment to that until liquidity came back. Liquidity has come back, the price has rallied strongly, and we've gone back to market pricing.
So it's just an adjustment in the value of it?
It was an adjustment in the value to reflect the staleness or the perception that the price was stale in the market.
Okay,
But that's now been removed and gone to zero.
And so, and you say that this is still, in your eyes, a good strategy. What are the risks with it, as opposed to being a shareholder in a company? What are the risks with going down this road of investing in royalties?
The royalty companies generally trade at a premium in terms of valuation to ordinary mining companies because of the reduced risk profile of investing in a royalty itself, because you're not exposed to you get direct exposure to the revenue that the asset generates. So you get exposure to the commodity price and you get exposure to the volume of the metal or the commodity that's being produced. You don't get exposed to any changes in taxation. You don't get exposed to, you know, rising operating costs. You don't get exposed to how management might decide to reinvest successfully or not successfully the cash flows that the asset is producing. And you don't just get exposed to the dividend that comes out after everything else has been paid for, you know, either successfully or not by the management. And so therefore, because you're exposed to the top line of the financial statement of the company, royalties have a lower risk profile than investing in the companies themselves. Obviously, the risk that we didn't build into this was the breakout of Ebola into the country, which reduced the ability of the company to be able to refinance, which was one of the things that we knew as a risk going into the investment in the first place.
So, I mean, the risk is also that you just don't get any future revenue generation. If revenues drop, then your returns drop.
Yes. And the challenge with regards to this royalty is because of the inability to be able to attach the royalty to the mining license itself because of the mining code in Sierra Leone. If the royalty had been done in North America, in Australia, in Canada, then you're actually able to attach that royalty to the mining license itself because of the rules in those countries. And therefore, it would survive cycles of weakness in commodity prices. And when the asset comes back into production, the royalty would start paying again.
Mm. But so you did change, didn't you, the strategy around royalties and unquoted investments. And so what is the strategy now?
So we haven't changed the strategy. So the desire is still to be exposed to that particular part of the kind of security base that the company would issue. What we put into the guidelines is to work within a certain framework. So no more than 3% can be exposed to any one particular either unquoted investment or royalty investment at the time of investment itself. So we can't do 5% of the trust's assets into that. In addition, if where we have an investment both in a royalty or an unquoted investment, plus securities issued by that company, maybe a publicly traded bond or shares, the combined exposure can't go above 3% as well.
And do you think that's the key lesson that you learned from last year, or would you say there were other lessons?
I think, obviously, the investments, the failure of the Maranpa royalty contract, you know, some elements of the risk that was attached to that were outside of our control and impossible to be able to forecast. Other elements attached to that as well were other things that, you know, we probably didn't emphasize enough in some of it. But the main lesson that we've learned is about sizing.
But what were the things that you feel that you didn't emphasize enough then?
Well, with regards to the risk factors around the inability to be able to refinance, which was the key part, we knew they had to refinance. There was already debt in place. There was already project finance in place. So we knew that was there. We probably didn't pay enough attention to the timeliness of that with regards to putting that refinancing in place well ahead of something that we didn't think that was going to happen, which is the outbreak of Ebola. So, the two things are very inextricably linked.
Well, and I mean, more generally, mining and commodities, they've always been, there's no guarantee of returns there, is there, by any means. Talk us through some of the issues in that sector over the past 10 years.
It's actually been a decade of two halves. So the performance of the sector was incredibly strong from, say, 2001 right through to 2011 when the NAV of the trust peaked. And then it's deteriorated since 2011 to where we are today. So it's been very much one of two halves. Obviously, the last few years have been unprecedented in terms of their nature. So we've never had four consecutive years of negative return. We've never had four consecutive years of this sector underperforming world markets. So we're very much in uncharted territory. We're starting to see signs that things are improving quite significantly, and we've been trying to communicate that to our shareholders over the last at least 12 months. So many of those signs are looking like a positive future. However, given the recent experience, you have to be quite cautious in believing these things too early. So we're positioning the portfolio today for that, but we're not going in as aggressively as we would probably like to, because of some of the uncertainties that still exist in the market, like with regards to what's happening in Greece, what that means for Europe, what's happening in China with regards to the instability in the stock market there. So there are many factors that are kind of holding us back from becoming a little bit more excited. And the reason why we're getting more excited is because the companies are doing a great job now. There's a lot of self-help initiatives. There's very, very strong yield support for the equities in the market today. BHP, the world's largest mining companies, on a dividend yield of 7% with a strong balance sheet. Other examples of that are commonplace throughout the sector.
And why are those yields so large? Does that not imply risk?
I think the reason why the yield is large today for a lot of these companies is there are some people in the market who believe that the yield is unsustainable, and some people who believe the yield is sustainable, and
you believe it is.
Yeah, well, everything that the company is saying, the BHP and other companies, is BHP hasn't cut their dividend for 100 years, so that's quite a long track record to say they're suddenly going to be wrong on it. The balance sheet is strong. They've got lots of tools to be able to reduce operating costs. They've been incredibly successful in cutting operating costs, incredibly successful in changing the focus away from reinvestment of cash flows back into growth assets to paying down debt and returning the money to shareholders. This has been in place now for several years. It's a strategy that's been re-emphasized at every opportunity by the executive team and by the board. So you're having to come to the assumption that everybody is wrong with regards to who runs the company, and therefore the dividend yield is not going to be sustainable. And they've had every opportunity with regards to, in BHP's case, with the spin out of the South 32 assets, to reset that, and they've chosen not to because they believe in the sustainability of that. So I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, and I think that yield is sustainable in that specific case.
So if London Mining hadn't happened and you were feeling more aggressive, what would you be doing differently?
So I didn't say that London Mining had changed that. I said that the consecutiveness of four negative years in a row was the big factor that had been kind of overhanging us. London Mining is one element of that. It cost the portfolio 5 to 6% or 6 and a bit percent of loss in NAV. The much bigger fall has happened with the market rather than London Mining.
Okay.
So I think the uncertainties that exist around some of the bigger macro issues in the market today is what's holding us back from really emphasizing the strong signals that we're starting to see from the fundamentals. So, a number of commodities are going into deficit. Normally, that's very, very supportive for commodity prices. Other commodities are in oversupply. Those are the ones we don't have exposure to. So exposure to coal today, is de minimis in our portfolio right now, whereas in the past it would have been big positions. Platinum, no exposure to platinum in the market. In the trust today. That was a huge, huge bet for us many, many times over the last 20 years. So, and we've made a huge bet today, exposure to copper. That bet in copper that we have today is one of the biggest bets we've had for a while. It's a high conviction position for us. Mm-hmm. Lots of growth companies, well-managed, strong balance sheets, and the prospect of a commodity that's going into deficit and therefore potential for price increases.
Copper's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I think copper was kind of one of the standouts in terms of being a stronger performer. But then it did crash in January, didn't it? And isn't copper quite connected to China? And with all these concerns about a Chinese slowdown in growth, is that a worry?
Yeah, absolutely. So you've always got elements of concern when you're making forecasts. Otherwise, you would be, you know,
it's commodities, which is, I guess, always a riskier area.
Commodities in nature have a higher volatility than other areas of the equity market. So the implied volatilities the historical volatilities in this sector are, you know, between 25% and 30% on an annual basis, which is much higher than market volatility. So you're absolutely right if that's your definition of risk. With regards to copper itself, you know, China is the world's largest consumer of copper. It's the world's largest consumer of every commodity. So there's China risk in every single commodity. The only commodity that China isn't the largest commodity consumer today is in oil. You know, there's a China factor in everything that you're looking at with regards to the commodity space.
Okay. So what are kind of your biggest bets or the areas that you think will do well this year other than copper?
So copper is our main bet. We've got, you know, around 20% of the portfolio exposed directly to copper investments. We have other exposure to copper indirectly in companies like Rio Tinto and BHP, which are copper producers. Areas that I mentioned that we're underweight, we've already touched on with regards to coal, and platinum, which are big themes for us. Today we have a significant position in gold exposure, but it's very specific to certain companies. So we don't have exposure to some of the world's largest gold producers. We just feel that the balance sheet stresses that they're under and the inability for them to be able to cut costs in response to the lower price environment is going to cause them problems. Whereas we have, you know, large overweight positions in certain gold stocks that are well-financed, have high levels of growth and good operating costs and a fantastic dividend culture. So again, meeting our goals to meet our dividend commitments to shareholders. Other areas that we think are attractive, we think that the nickel market is looking increasingly attractive, but we haven't yet made that large bet for the portfolio. The zinc market has already gone into deficit, so prices are likely to be better in the future than they have been in the past. The challenge with zinc is to be able to get enough pure play exposure to zinc in the portfolio, because there aren't that many pure listed zinc stocks to be able to play with that. And then there are other commodities at the fringe in the industrial mineral space, which we think are attractive as well. And the last element is silver. So although the outlook for silver prices, we think, isn't that attractive, the quality of the companies and the profitability of the companies that we've chosen to invest in is, we think, pretty much world class. So the silver price today is between $15 and $16 an ounce. The companies we're invested in produce it for about $8. That's a great business.
Now, you've talked a bit about dividends, and you did pledge to maintain the dividend at the end of the last financial year, didn't you? So is there an issue with having a lower level of revenue to cover that dividend? How well placed are you there? And are you planning on maintaining the dividend again this year?
Yeah, so last year, after the events of Maranpa, as we've already discussed, the board said that the final dividend of 14p would be paid out to shareholders, making 21p for the year, which is the third year of 21p in a row. That yield has been paid and the shareholders received the dividend. What the board has said throughout this year is that they would look at the dividend throughout the year and see how the income comes into the portfolio and make a decision on the dividend as the year unfolds, to try and forecast what our yield would be at the start of the year when we haven't received any income at all from anybody, because all we do is receive the dividends from companies that we're invested in, would be a bit bold, because we don't know what those companies are going to do. Obviously, we have a view, but to base our forecast on what companies might or might not do with regards to their dividend decisions would be relatively risky. So we haven't given any guidance for dividends this year. The goal for the trust is to be able to pay out an interim dividend and a final dividend. And I think any guidance that we would give to shareholders would obviously come with the interim dividend, which will be an August event.
Okay. And you also use derivatives, don't you, to generate a bit of extra income? How does that work, and how has that strategy been, how effective has it been?
Yeah, so we don't necessarily use derivatives to generate income. We use derivatives for efficient portfolio management. One of the outputs of that is income generation. So it's not specifically just for income itself.
No, but that is an offshoot of using them, is it not?
Absolutely, as I said. It does contribute. In the past, depends on where you take the return returns from the income from the option writing. Sometimes you take it to capital, sometimes you take it to income. It depends on the accounting treatment. So what we have done throughout the life of the trust is to sell volatility out to the market where we think volatility is mispriced. So as you commented earlier on, this sector is highly volatile. And so therefore, volatility is often overpriced into certain financial instruments. And what we have done incredibly successfully over a very, very long period of time is to opportunistically sell that volatility where we think it is mispriced into an option contract, either by selling a call option, which is covered on our existing positions. So if we feel that a certain stock has reached a level that we would be happy to sell it at or is getting close to a sell level, and we can achieve that exit and get paid extra for making a commitment to sell it at a price that we would be happy to sell it at in the future, a price that doesn't yet already exist, then that's a very sensible use of the capital of the trust. Likewise, in the opposite, if a share is getting close to a level where we'd be happy to buy it, and we can take on a put option position, and that the use of options in as a tool there typically adds to the income mix over time if the premiums from the option writing are taken to income rather than taken to capital.
And how has the first half of this year been? Because you have outperformed the benchmark, haven't you, over 1 and 3 months, I believe?
Yeah, I think the first half of the year ended a couple of days ago, and we have outperformed over the last 6 months, yeah.
And how are you feeling about the portfolio going forward?
I think we're very happy with the portfolio. We're very pleased to have completed all of the work with regards to our royalty investment. The Avanco royalty is likely to, the company said that they're aiming for first production before the end of this year. It's a small investment for the trust. It's only $12 million out of our portfolio, which is obviously it's a relatively small amount of money.
What kind of percentage is that then?
Today we're about £600 million of assets, £700 million with about gross assets. So it takes you to just over $1 billion. So it's about 1% and a bit.
How happy are you with the discount currently, which is around an 8% discount?
Yeah, so it's interesting. The discount has actually halved over the last few weeks. And I think there was quite a lot of speculation in the market with regards to the index inclusion and the changes around there, and that there would be a lot of liquidity coming out, and the discount widened before that event happened. And that event happened, and the discount has now narrowed significantly. I think the discount is obviously very closely linked to the income that the trust is going to be able to pay back to its shareholders. As I mentioned earlier on, one of the strategies that the trust, that the board went down with regards to the trust, was to try and narrow that discount by the income potential. And as the income potential has continued to grow inside the portfolio, then obviously maintaining that is going to be key to be able to bring that discount back into a narrow level. Prior to the events of Maranpa, we were actually trading at a premium. So it had been a very successful strategy.
Okay. Great. I think that's probably all we have time for. So thank you very much to Evie Hambrough.
Great. Thank you very much.
Some interesting ways to get exposure to commodities there. This brings us to the end of this week's podcast, so it just remains to thank special guest David Liddell, founder of online investment advisory service Ipso Facto Investor, Kenneth McKenzie, manager of Target Healthcare REIT, and Evie Hambrough, manager of BlackRock World Mining Trust. Thanks also to personal finance writer Kate Bealey. You can read more about finding the right investment strategy, the budget, and alternative property investment trusts in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle. Thank you for listening, and have a great weekend.